Ah, you may be seated. Thank you for being here today. Let's give the band a round of another. Man, they're good and they're getting lots of love this weekend, and rightfully so. How many have seen the movie, it's kind of old now, Cool Runnings? You ever seen that? I'm amazed how many people have seen that this weekend. You didn't see it this weekend, but I've been asking people this weekend, and it's an amazing amount of people. John Candy, who I miss, I love John Candy. I thought he was a really funny guy. But that was his last film that he was ever in. And it's a movie roughly based on a true story. Loosely based on a true story. And it's about a bobsled team. And you'd think it wouldn't be very funny as John Candy's the coach of the bobsled team, but it's funny because the team is from Jamaica. That's what makes the movie kind of funny. John Candy and a team from Jamaica. And he's loved and beloved in the film. John Candy is that he's dubbed the sled god in the movie. And later in the movie, he admits kind of to a dark past. There's some history there. And what happened was, and most of you have seen it, so I don't need to explain it in much detail, but he cheated. He won an Olympic gold in one Olympics, and then the next Olympics, he added some weight to the sled, which helps the sled get down the mountain faster, or down the track faster, and he got caught. He was disgraced. The whole team was disgraced, and one of the Jamaican bobsledders couldn't understand why anyone who'd already won a gold medal would cheat. And he nervously asked John Candy about it, and here's his reply. John said, "I had to win. But," he said, "I learned something. I learned this. If you are not happy without a gold medal, you will not be happy with one either." You see, happiness, as some Englishman wrote about us Americans, he said, "The trouble with you Americans is that you have to be so confoundedly happy all the time." Sounds English, right? "You have dedicated yourselves to the pursuit of happiness. You boast about it as an inalienable right, as though happiness were the supreme and absolute goal of all existence. Surely there are more important things than just being happy." And you know what? It is an American thing. And it's kind of strange to me that we put in our Declaration of Independence, we have life, you have liberty, and then right there with it, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those are the same. Those are the same things, really. And I know people, and I'm sure you do too, friends, neighbors, a few church members who live with this on the very front of their brain. They wake up every day, and they have one mission, one goal, one purpose. What's the goal? What's the purpose? What's the mission for today? Same as yesterday, and the same will be today, tomorrow, if I had to live another day. And it's the same goal, and the goal is, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to be a 100% American. I'm going to pursue whatever it is I have to pursue to make me happy. That's what we're about. That is the American way. We are 100% devoted. We are completely sold out to the pursuit, I call it the chase, of happiness. And isn't it strange how folks go about it? It's all different. One man buys a dozen homes to be happy. Another man goes out into the wilderness to live as a hermit to be happy. One woman becomes a nun. Another woman becomes, well, the opposite of a nun. Let's just say that. One man thinks bodybuilding will bring him happiness. Another man thinks he destroy his body with drugs. That will bring him happiness. One couple thinks having children is the way to happiness, so they have 5, 6, 7, 8. I think of Leto. I keep telling him, stop having kids, man. There are better ways to grow a church. Another couple's convinced that children get in the way of happiness, so they go childless. I mean, C.S. Lewis, in his satire called The Screwtape Letters, has the archdevil Screwtape advising his little apprentices on how they are going to go about deceiving people. And he tells them this: here's how you do it. Here's how you're going to deceive them. Here's how we're going to win. Through an ever-increasing craving for an ever-diminishing pleasure. Think about it for a second and just think if that doesn't sound like America. Just think about this. Here's how we're going to win, little demons. We're going to go out there and we're going to tempt them. We're going to bait them. We're going to sell them this. We're going to do it through an ever-increasing craving for an ever-diminishing pleasure. And boy, I want to tell you, it kind of works. Neil Postman wrote years ago about America and the lifestyle of the American people. He entitled the book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And it really, I mean, if we do not have, even among Christians, a vital relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ, our lives, we can spend our lives consumed with the hot chase. We're going to get happy. We're going to take care of this. And in reality, we're just trying, most of us, to deaden the pain of an empty life. And we're going to begin a series on what we call the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5. And actually, the part of the sermon is called the Beatitudes. We're just looking at one part of this sermon that Jesus gave there on the hillside. And you probably know a lot about it, maybe not. I don't know where you're coming from here today, but we're going to try to explain all this in pretty good detail. The word Beatitudes in Latin is the word beatus, which means blessed. And they say that the Sermon on the Mount is really Jesus' first big sermon, and it really is the essence of all of Christendom. It's the essence of the Christian life. The values and all of those great lines in there. There's one after another. Most of them are shocking. Most of them are really eye-opening. If somebody asks you to, you know, for example, go with you a mile, go with him too. And that's just loaded with line after line after line. But inside that sermon, there's about 10 verses we call the Beatitudes. And they call the Beatitudes the essence of the Sermon on the Mount. So the Sermon on the Mount is the essence of the Christian life. We are really looking at the essence of the essence of what it means to be a Christian, what it means to be a Christ follower. And at the very core, we're looking at the very center of what Jesus is saying to us. These are the values, these are the principles, this is the core. This is what it means to be a Christ follower. So try to underline these. Try to get these. I'm zeroing in on what really it means to be a Christ follower. What it means to be, well, we're using the word happy. Some translators have taken that word and rearranged it a little bit, and they've translated it into the word happy, but it was originally the word blessed. And that's really what it means, and I don't mind either word, really. The word blessed, it was seldom used, and it was only used when describing gods, and that's small g gods. This word was always connected to false gods. They would refer to the blessed gods. And then it starts popping up in the Bible. It popped up in Timothy a couple of times. God, the blessed and only ruler. The gospel according to the blessed God, our blessed God. It was referred to our God now. And we find it a couple times in the book of Psalms. A psalmist uses this word. We also find in the original language of the New Testament that the word "are" was not included in the text. And in some Bibles, not many now, but it used to be all the Bibles, the word "are" would be in italics, which would mean that it was not in the part of the original manuscript. It was only added by an English translator so it would read better. So if you read from the original transcript, it would read like this: blessed the poor in spirit. Blessed those who mourn. Blessed the merciful. and on through the text. And this is an exclamation, listen, of joy and happiness for those who possess these qualities. The psalmist says in the first chapter, blessed is the one who doesn't walk in the steps of the wicked or stand in the way of the sinners. Blessed, blissful, happy, exquisitely happy is that person. And we find in Psalm 32, 2, blessed is the man whose sin does not count against him and in whose spirit is no deceit. And on through the Bible, we have these things. And this is the term that Jesus picks up and he uses in what we call the blessings, the Beatitudes. Some people call them the happy attitudes. These are the happy attitudes. Some say these are the attitudes that ought to be. That's what Jesus is really saying, the be attitudes. These are the attitudes that ought to be inside of us as Christ followers. I just call them happy-tudes. I don't know what it means, but I like the term. I came up with it. These are happy-tudes. And we all ought to have these happy-tudes in our life. They are incredibly unique. And what I love about the happy-tudes, more than anything else, the greatness of them, is that they're not some prophecy. They're not some forward, wishful dream. This isn't some golden promise of some glorious future way down the road. These are shouts of joy and happiness for us today. We can have them today. We can have them right now, and no one can ever take them away from us. They are available to every single person here. Next week, we're going to go down. We're going to look at them one at a time. We're going to look at each happitude, and we're going to examine them and see if we can't apply some of this to our own lives. But I want to just today, in the time we have left, just kind of lay some foundation for the rest of this series, just kind of some prep work, if you will. And so if you have your notes, grab them. Here's the first thought. The chasing true happiness is part of God's purpose for you. Now, a lot of people say, well, preacher, we've heard you say just the opposite. You're talking out of both sides of your mouth, which is hard to do.
Well, I can do that because I got a mic over here.
I'm pretty good at it. But I just want you to know that really, I have said things like this. God didn't go to the cross and come out of the tomb and go to heaven and make all these promises so that you could be happy. I have said that. He did all that so you'd be holy. I have said that. You say, well, then you're contradicting yourself. No, not really. You see, the difference and the problem is we have a different definition of what happiness really is. Our definition and his definition don't usually line up. So when I'm saying God didn't do all this for you to be happy, I'm talking about your definition of happiness. But he did do all of that so that you would be happy, his definition of happiness. God wants you to be truly happy. God wants you to have real joy, real fulfillment, real blessedness. God does want that for you. I have no question about it. But you know what he doesn't want? He doesn't want you waking up with one thing on your mind. Today is the day. Like every other day of my life, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to find it. I'm going to get it. I'm going to pursue it. I am going to chase it. And nothing is going to get in my way until I get my arms around it and I take it back home with me and I marry it. I am going to find happiness. It's the chase that ruins everything. It just doesn't work that way. And I meet people, and you know people, who just are not happy no matter what happens, no matter what's going on. Everything could be going great, they're not happy. Everything could be awful, and of course, they're still not happy. How many know somebody, no matter what happens, they're not going to be happy? Do you know anybody? Don't point at other people, but just raise your hand. I know some people, and they're just not happy. Something great happens, they might smile for half a second, but they just cannot be happy. I know folks who believe that if you are saved, you're supposed to look you know, doom and gloom, and the way that they look, they are a true advertisement for their actual philosophy of life. We had a family in our church fellowship who, well, they got upset a lot, and it was mostly her. I'll be honest with you. She pretty much directed where the family would go and when they would go and how they would go, and just was pretty clear to anybody who knew them. And they'd get upset, and if anything ever went wrong, they'd just leave. They'd just quit. I mean, you'd get a message, you get a word from a friend or a coworker, they're gone, and they don't like you, and they're gone, and they quit, and they want you to know it, and it's just, you know, right in my face, and all that stuff, and it's kind of hurtful, but then you get over it, and then, you know, unfortunately, they come back about 6 months later, you know, and they go, okay, they're back. How am I going to keep them happy this time? I'm really going to keep them happy this time. I'll do everything I can do. And guess what? Something doesn't go their way, and boom, they're gone again, and it's my fault. And then they're back. And this has repeated itself time and time and time again. And about 4.5 months ago, she sent an email. She didn't send it to me, but she sent it to one of my closest staff members, part of my family, and said, this is what she said, and I'm going to read it to you. It's going to get good. You're going to like it. It won't take long. It takes about 7 seconds, and it'll be over. So don't worry about time here. The email said, got to find it here. Oh, yeah, we are out of here. We are gone. We are going to attend another church. We are so sick and tired of hearing Pastor David talk about his granddaughter. And they left. I haven't seen them since. And the only reason I'm telling this is because I'm pretty sure it will ensure that they will not return this time. And the reality is, I don't know why they left. It had actually nothing to do with me. It had nothing to do with my grandbaby. What it has to do with, these people are not happy. They don't understand the meaning of it. They don't understand the purpose of it. They don't understand what it means to be a church member and what it means to be a Christ follower. That's just something they just threw out there. I mean, some folks are convinced that if you're going to be saved, if you're going to be a Christian, you've got to be serious. You've got to have a somber look about you. And in order for somebody to be godly, he or she has to look like, you know, some sort of reject from a pickle factory. They're out there. They're in here right now. There's probably a couple who think we should not be laughing in church. Why would you make fun of Leto? Why would you do that? Because it's easy. Don't laugh. People are offended by this. People believe that holiness and unhappiness are synonymous. C.S. Lewis was asked as a kid, before he was ever a great author and Christian, he was asked what he thought God was like, and he answered that so far as he could make out, God is kind of a person who is always snooping around to see if anyone's enjoying himself so that he can put a stop to it. A lot of people have that philosophy. And I will tell you, as we read these, in the coming weeks, we go through these Beatitudes, these Happitudes, you're going to probably struggle with some of them. It's shocking to anybody who hasn't really read or studied. It will not sound like this is what the Lord might tell his people in his big first sermon that's recorded. You'd think it'd be something different. But I want to remind you, it's the same Jesus who also said in John 10, I have come that they may have life, and that they may have the abundant life, that they may have it to the full. Yeah, well, what does that mean? It means that, yes, Jesus wants to be your Savior. Yes, He wants to be your Lord, but He also wants your life to be fulfilling. He also wants you to have a joy down deep in your heart. He wants you to have His heart. We're going to see in a minute. And his heart is filled with joy. That's his desire for each and every one of us here. And those people who portray Jesus as this sorrowful, sad player, who walks across the stage of the New Testament, I believe in my heart they have been misreading the Jesus that I have been reading about. They've probably had a preacher who portrayed him that way forever and ever or something. One of the words that describes Jesus, as a kid, I heard. I didn't know what the word meant, so I looked it up. It's the word winsome. Jesus was always winsome. And if you look that up, you'll find the definition is absolutely amazing. And I believe it 100% that Jesus was winsome, and he is winsome, and we're supposed to be winsome. And the definition of it, you look it up, it's the word, it means pleasant. Jesus was pleasant. It means engaging. Jesus was engaging. He was charming. He was endearing. He was appealing. People liked to be around him. A man from Nazareth took such a great delight in being alive and just living and being with people. In Matthew chapter 11, his enemies who did not like Jesus enjoying life, they decided they would, what they wanted to do was get rid of him. What they wanted to do was to eliminate his entire ministry. And they thought this would do it. When they set about Jesus, and Jesus was doing nothing but just living his life, but they set about Jesus in Matthew 11, 9, the Son of Man, he came eating and drinking, and they called him a glutton, and they called him a drunkard, and then they threw in, he's also a friend of tax collectors. Disgusting. This Jesus guy. And as you read through the Gospels, you will know that he enjoyed life. He was very comfortable at a wedding. In fact, he was kind of the reluctant star at the wedding. He enjoyed himself at the banquet. He was always the center of a gathering of friends in anyone's home. He mingled with, the Bible uses a term, now this is not political, publicans, not Republicans, publicans, and sinners, not Democrats, sinners, that's a different, you guys get all this confused politically, and I'm not talking about any of that. It says that he hung out with the publicans, he mingled with the sinners, he attracted, also says he attracted little children to him. I mean, that's a thought, isn't it? You've noticed there are certain kinds of people that draw children to them. There are other kinds of people that scare children. Jesus attracted children. He was winsome. And I don't think you're reading too much into the story at all when I tell you I think he had an awesome sense of humor. He certainly was witty. He certainly turned the tables on them. Every time they asked him a question, instead of answering, he asked them a better question they couldn't answer. One time he drew an outrageous word picture. He said he drew a picture of a guy. He told a story about a guy who had this large plank hanging out of his eye. I couldn't even see his gigantic plank, and yet he was straining and squinting and trying to get a little speck out of his brother's eye. That may not be funny to you, but in that culture, if you translated it, I'm telling you, it was funny. People were trying to keep from laughing in his presence because he got them with his sense of humor. And yet most of the paintings, you have the droopy, sad, forlorn Jesus. Jesus wants you to be blessed. Truly blessed. Not blessed according to most of our standards, but according to his standards. And if you'll go through here, you're going to find what it means to truly be blessed. And I want to go on the record. I want you to hear me. I believe with all of my heart, and I want to remind everyone here, Jesus Christ wants David Rutherford to be happy. He wants me to get up. He wants me to have joy in my heart. He wants me to greet people. He wants me to smile at people. He wants me to put my best foot forward. He wants me to have real joy, unspeakable joy, down deep in my heart every single day. And I gotta be honest with you, I don't always have it. I mean, some days, you know, it's just I don't always live like that. But I'm telling you, that's what he wants. And he doesn't just want it for me. He wants it for you. I showed this video many, many years ago. A little girl, I just love it. I wish I could wake up every day like this little girl and just have this kind of enthusiasm about what God has in front of me. I would say about one day a week I'm like this, and the rest of the week I struggle. But here's an old video you've probably seen.
Look, I can be a shark. Now my whole house is great. I can do anything good. I like my school. I like anything. I like my dad. I like my cousins. I like my aunts. I like my Allisons. I like my mom. I like my sisters. I like my dad. I like I like my hair. I like my haircuts. I like my pajamas. I like my stuff. I like my rooms. I like my home. My whole house is great. I can do anything good. Yeah. I can do anything good. Better than anyone.
Don't you love it? I like my church. I like my staff. I like my congregation. I like my house. I like it all. I love it all. I can do anything good. I love it. And it may seem unrealistic to you, but I think there's something deep within us that really, that is what the Lord wants for us. Number two in your notes, chasing true happiness is an inward journey, not an outward journey. The chase is not out here. And yet, that's how we are trained. This is we're raised this way. We are a byproduct of our culture, and it's human nature to a real degree. We believe, as the world has told us, that if you really want to be happy, you got to get out here. You got to do this. You got to have that. And it's all kind of an external thing. When Jesus is actually telling us in this passage over and over and over again, we're going to look at it very, very in depth. It has nothing to do with what's out here, and it has everything to do with what's in here. Not one time when Jesus is talking about true blessedness does he mention health or wealth or work or adequate income or financial security or your home or love or even friends. He knew that those things often accompanied happiness. But they do not produce happiness. They just don't. Think about it. The blessedness, just the opposite of the world standards now. All of the bliss of the poor. All of the blessedness of the hungry and the thirsty. And the persecuted, and the sorrowful. And if you haven't heard this, if you haven't gone down this and really closely looked at it, no one can hear this for the first time without a little shock and amazement. Who would say these kinds of things? Who would be the author of this context? I will tell you, the Beatitudes are a paradox to the human mind, and I believe what Jesus is doing, he's trying to eliminate, he's actually trying to destroy all of the foolish notions that the illusions that these people had in his day. They grew up in that day and age, they had this mindset, and you know what they were after? They were thinking that Jesus is going to be their leader. And they're going to start this new thing, a new kingdom. And they were thinking about power. They were thinking about overtaking the enemy. They were thinking about dominating. They were thinking about a new order of things. They're no longer going to be bossed around. They're now going to be the ones in charge. They were thinking about being in complete control. And here comes their leader, and he's dynamic, and they like him, and he's got a sense of humor, and he's a great teacher, and so they're listening intently, and they're like, okay, we're ready. Well, listen, I got to tell you about the kingdom. That's just what we want to hear about. We're ready for the new world power. We're ready for prosperity. We're ready for all of this stuff. And Jesus says, well, I got some good news and some bad news. You can have it. You can have it all. But you need to know it's not about all of these things out here. It's really these kingdom principles. We're not talking about this kingdom. We're talking about this kingdom. Therefore, these principles really are not external. They are all internal. These are the attitudes that ought to be. These are the attitudes of the heart. This is all an inside job. It has nothing to do with what you think. It has everything to do with. And if you get this right, then you will be truly happy. You can imagine, most of them didn't quite track with what he was saying. You want to be happy? Oh, absolutely. Okay, I've got the formula. Brace yourself. Blessed are the poor in spirit. What? Before I go on to the next point, let me just be the big heavenly killjoy that I usually am. I've accepted the role. I've actually embraced it. Some of you are looking for happiness. Some of you are looking for blessedness. Some of you are looking for fulfillment. You are actually and a search for real joy, and I just want to tell you, you can have it, but you're probably not going to find it where you're looking. And I can just guarantee you, you're not going to find it in Las Vegas. And you're not going to find it at the beach. Preacher, how could you? And you're not going to find it up at the cabin, and you're not going to find it on the soccer field, and you're not going to find it living vicariously through your little precious children. You're not going to find it at the movies. You're not going to find it out here. The only place you're going to find it is in here. It's a journey inward, and most of us have, well, a lot of us have not yet made that trip. Number three, chasing true happiness is not a goal. It should not be a goal. It should be a byproduct. And if we're not careful, we make the search the goal. And if that's your goal, you're just never going to find it, like that bad dream I have all the time of having some, usually it's a few pennies in my hand, and I wake up and it is gone. It just doesn't work that way. And you say, preacher, do you have a problem with us going to the beach? Absolutely not. I know I come across that way sometimes. I love it. I love that we can have fun and we can enjoy life and all of that stuff. But what I struggle with and what just gets me is when I see folks, and you can just tell, that's all they're after. They cannot stop themselves. They are on a 100% pursuit every single day. They are in the chase. And the people who are in the chase, and that's their goal, and that's their life motive, they never find it. Because happiness, true happiness, comes as a byproduct of going after something else. Real joy, real fulfillment is a byproduct of something else. It's never the goal. It doesn't work that way. Some man said this. I'm going to read this statement to you. You tell me who you think said it. Who might have said these words? Here's the statement. I must be the happiest man in the whole world. I've never met anyone who has had as much fun as I've had. Was that some playboy who had run the gamut of sexual pleasure and trotted around the globe in some sort of bohemian existence, some Hugh Hefner type? Was that from an adventurer who had visited the jungles of South America or scaled the slopes of Mount Everest? Who could have said, I believe I must be the happiest man in the whole world. I have never met anyone who has had as much fun as I've had. It was said by Frank Laubach, who happens to be a missionary, who spent his entire life teaching literacy to the backward peoples of the world. Mr. Laubach never went looking for happiness, but boy, did he find it. He found it because happiness is a byproduct of a search for something more. In one of his writings, he actually said, I cannot describe to you the delight of people when they first discovered that they can read. Men go hysterical. Women begin to weep for joy. There could not be another work in the world which could possibly have brought so much happiness. I truly believe I am the happiest man in the world. No one could have ever had as much fun as I've had. Do you know anybody like that? I mean, you look at them from the outside and you think, well, hey, this isn't going great for this guy. But then you get to know him or her, and you realize that somewhere deep down they have a fulfillment and an understanding and a peace and a joy that can only come from above. That's different than yours. You wonder, how could this person be happy? This outer shell doesn't look very good, but oh, there is an inner joy. They are enthusiastic about why they are here. They are exuberant about God's plan and purpose in their life. I'm thinking of our missionaries that we sent to Mexico, Anthony and Kimberly Doy, and they left everything. It sounds trite. It sounds like just a cliche, but they sold their home. They left their family. They left their friends. They left all the comforts that you and I enjoy. There may be a little bit of internet every now and a week, something like that, but basically no communication. I mean, it's like third world. They went to the mountains of Mexico, up in the middle of nowhere, almost impossible to get to, dealing with basically a tribe of people, the Huichol Indians. And they're just there giving everything they have. They're just serving, just loving, just giving. I would love for God to reveal their happiness meter. I got a feeling it's a lot higher than most of us in this room. I just believe that with all of my heart. And somebody said this, and I really think this is one of the keys, and these aren't my words, but I love it. It's quite a line. If more people would get a divorce from themselves, which I've considered, they might learn how to live happily with someone else. You see, the world has a way of short-circuiting true happiness because they make us think that it has everything to do with this, possessions, finances, items, the setup, the retreat place. It just, everything's about the external, when really the Lord is telling us it is all about the journey inward. It's about what's inside. I close with saying that the chase will lead us ultimately to Jesus Christ. He was a happy man. I have every reason to believe it as I read the Gospels, and I have read it many times and actually spent a lot of time studying it. You say, well, why do you think Jesus was happy? He had a lot on his mind. He was headed to the cross. There's a lot of reasons to be burdened and stressed. I think he had some of that for sure, no doubt. But I believe with all of my heart, he was extremely happy. You say, why do you believe that? Well, number one, he had relationships. You have good relationships, you're usually going to have some happiness in your life. He had friends. He had close friends, the Bible says. I mean, he was a happy person. He had not only that, but he had a few what we would call creature comforts. Not always and not all the time, but on occasion he had them. He was entertained by some very wealthy people who cared for him. That's a pretty good deal. He had the opportunity to do what he wanted to do the most. He had the opportunity to do that which he loved. What a great pleasure to do what God's called you to do. Boy, he did that, I mean, in spades. If you're somebody here today, it's a privilege to do what God's called you to do. You know that brings great joy. He could teach. Man, if you can teach, just like the guy I just talked about, you know, teaching people literacy, if you can teach and you see somebody go from here to there, man, I don't think there was a better teacher than him. Think of the joy he got in teaching people and discipling people and teaching people about God. Not only that, but he healed people all the time. Can you imagine healing somebody? You walk into a room, a guy's laid up in the bed, and you go, hey, man, get up, and he gets up and walks out. You'd be going, wow, this is unbelievable. Look what I did. I mean, he had joy in his life. I just think God wants life to be somewhat pleasurable for those who love him. There are more good days than bad days for, I mean, every one of us. And he opened these doors for his enjoyment. Every day there were opportunities to enjoy life. And I think his father wanted him to enjoy life. And yet, in the final weeks of his life, one by one, those doors of pleasure and happiness, they slammed shut in his face. One by one, until you get to the upper room, and that final door slams shut in his face. And his brief ministry, by anyone who was looking from the outside in, would say, "Ugh, that's a complete failure." And he had only one thing that was he was looking forward to, and that was what we call the cross, a Roman crucifixion. And his close friends, who were a source of joy to him, they either betrayed him, deserted him, or denied him. And it was in that atmosphere, friend, that he says to them in that upper room where the final door has slammed, John 15:10, "These things I have spoken to you, everything I've said, so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full." What? Can you imagine? Every door slammed, all of your comforts gone, all of your support system gone, all of the doors slammed shut, and Jesus says, "And gentlemen, I want you to know the secret of my joy, so that you can have it, so that your joy will be real and full." That is difficult to just picture. The one thing he would talk about in that moment, his joy, and that he wants you to have that joy. And I believe the only way he had that joy is because he woke up every day, not in the pursuit of happiness, not in the pursuit of joy, but he woke up every day with this concept of, I want to be right in the middle of God's will. I want to do what God wants me to do today. And when he was doing that, when he was chasing that, that brought about great joy. And even though he was staring face on, headlong into the depths and the pain and the gore and the blood of the crucifixion, he said, "Guys, I want to tell you something about joy. I want to tell you something about fulfillment. I want to tell you something about happiness. Listen to me for a second." John 4, he said, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me." My food is to do the will of him who sent me. Every single day, he tried to get in the middle, in the center of God's will. And I want to tell you, we're going to read some of these things, and you're not going to want to see them. You're not going to want to hear all of them. But I'm telling you, as we take them and we try our very best, just to be open about them and listen, don't be intimidated, don't be scared. We're not talking about outward stuff. We're just talking about matters of the heart. Inward attitudes, happitudes. You can get there. You can get there. You just got to look at what Jesus is really talking about and how he wants you to apply these things to your life. We're going to stand. And if you're here today and you have any decision on your heart, If you have anything that you want to pray about or talk to somebody about, just step down to the front as we stand and sing.